Come on. Hello and welcome to Dynamite, the Retro Games Podcast, where a couple of owl pals get together and talk about a couple of owl games. The voice you're hearing just now is myself, Snottery Mick Clockerty. Joining me, as always, we've got Sleepy Andy Mac.
Karichiwa.
And fresh in for a night out, Mr. Mick McCormick.
How's it going? I'm completely sober, by the way. I might not sound it.
I was going to say, I was expecting we'd be bringing three sort of very different energies to this episode.
That's what we live for.
Aye. Well, that's always been the case, so why change it now?
Aye. Well, lads, what you've been up to, how you've been getting on?
All right, man. In terms of games, I've found my new calling, man. I found my new calling, my new pastime, right?
Oh, you're a Final Fantasy 14 guy now?
Man, well, do you know what? You know I love Final Fantasy, right? I'm into it. I've got my criticisms. Right. Repetitive battle systems, the old ones and all that stuff. Necessary evil. I kind of side with that argument. But this game, it's sucked me right in. In a way that other MMORPGs really haven't, I find that this one is sort of bridging the gaps in other MMORPGs that I've played, such as PSO2, the new Genesis game. It just seemed fucking empty, and it was just like a big list of daily things you had to complete and all that. And this game isn't like that. This game gives you like a big open world, and it's up to you what you want to do, where you want to explore.
Andy, I get the feeling, right, that there was a slot in your brain waiting for an MMO to be plugged into it. Because you've willed yourself to like a couple of them. You kept trying to get into PSO and all that. I think you've been waiting for one to come along.
I mean, you know me, man. I'm a big sucker for PSO, Phantasy Star Online. You know, it's fucking an affiliation made Dreamcast and all that. First ever online RPG. Yep. Even though it's not an RPG, it's a dungeon crawler, but it's the difference. Aye, so I've always appealed it. I've been on with different people from around the world. It was so novel back then that I couldn't believe that people could do that in their fucking bedrooms. But now, the whole fucking world's doing it, and I've still not got involved properly. Really involved, man.
So do you like the whole just a place to kind of hang about with a bunch of strangers sort of vibe
really,
while you're doing something? Are you just really solo in this and the other folk are just in the background?
I like, it's a weird gene, man, because it's got a really good story. You're basically in this big fantasy world, it's the final and all that, and I'm looking, it's a big world you're in. You cut about as I went a gladiator. I'm just a big Aryan fucking Norwegian gladiator guy. Don't ask me why. But I just cut about ripping things apart, man. And I just like the fact to look about and there's other people playing around you. But that's about the extent of the interactions for me. I don't really interact with anybody. What I'll do is, if I see somebody fighting, there's things called fates, F-A-T-E-S, and what it is, it's like a special battle that gives you more points and maybe even like an item or something like that, but you have to sync to the cunt's level, so it'll automatically boost your level so you can fight with him, and sometimes you can join in, like if he's needing a big gladiator, say there's three mages there, and they gladiator, and they're like, oh big man, come over, fucking scud this cunt. Jump over, man, just fucking get your baton out, man, just fucking club him a few times, and then everybody gets a split of the XP, and everybody's happy, and on your merry way you go. I quite like that aspect of it, man. There's loads of good things about this game, and I like the way that the missions aren't too complicated and don't take ages. Like, a mission would maybe be, oh, a robber's come into town and robbed every cunt, and the last time we seen him, there was this wee hut up the hill. Just go up the hill, bash his fucking brains in, take a look back, and that's literally all you do. You just go 100 metres, do your mission, back, bum.
After you smash a baddie, do you get a...
You sure fucking do, man. And the music is phenomenal, I'll tell you what. Godlike music, man. Godlike music. It's like...
Mick, do we know if it's a bold Mr. Nobu Matsu?
No, it's actually a new guy. It's, I think, one of his proteges that's been doing it. A lot of folk really rave about the music, and they say it's kind of mental as well. Like, it jumps between a whole load of different genres. It's, like, quite experimental, but all really good.
Aye. So I'm currently in a place called Yuldah, which is a city-state. There's all different cities, man. And it's like a... It's just like a fucking, kind of reminds me of a fucking, something, a Tatooine or something. Or a cross between Tatooine and Gladiator.
Aye.
You're surrounded by deserts and all that. Then obviously, you've got different like parts of the area where you can go in, like low level, medium level, high level and all that. And you just kind of make your way. It's fucking good. And there's loads of like wee villages about the town, mate, saying lore and all that. And it's pretty much a single player experience, most of it. But it does have that aspect where you can, it's either having a party, like your stuck party, you can sort of just like dip in and out of battles that are going on around you.
Aye.
It's fucking smashing. It's just good. It's addictive, but it's addictive. Like, you go, I just want more, man, because there's so much around you today. So,
Mr. McCormick, what have you been up to yourself?
So I've been playing a couple of games aside for my assigned ones. I've been getting back into The Binding of Isaac. They've had about 5 different versions since I last played that game. Fucking remakes and expansions and all sorts.
I'm a wee bit of an Isaac kid.
Aye, the one I'm playing is Afterbirth Plus, which is like an expansion of a...
Is that the pixel art one?
So they made a kind of remake for the ground up, which is called Rebirth, and that changed it for that kind of Flash game style animation to be pixel art as well, but like... Under the hood, I think, there was a lot of enhancements to the engine that allowed them to do more stuff, and then they released an expansion to that called Afterbirth, and then an enhanced version of that called Afterbirth Plus, which I'm playing. There's new hunters and hunters of different like abilities and power-ups and different modes and all that. I've only just started getting back into it. I'm still pretty rubbish at it. I do find it's just your luck if you get some like one or two good power-ups that really synergize with each other, or you can get an utter dross and get fucking hammered, but that's the meta game of it, isn't it?
I find that stressful. See if you do a couple of bosses and then you're like, hold on a minute, I've got fucking X, Y, and Z power up and I'm really well set up here. The pressure is now on you to do really fucking well and no mess this run up.
Yeah, that happened to me last time I was playing it. I had some amazing like blood laser hang that you could charge up, and I'd fought a couple of bosses and I was doing quite well, and then I fought hundreds of times and I've beat hundreds of times, but I just had bad luck with him and that just ended my run and all my beautiful power-ups, and I was back to all the shite.
7 Deadly Sins bosses and all of that, like Greed and Sloth and stuff, don't you?
I hear their name, but Afterbirth, it just fucking reminds me running out of fucking midway fucking thing, running away screaming.
It is fully intentional, Andy. This is a bit of a clatty game. It's all full of really sort of upsetting imagery, and like so the fella who made it is called Edmund McMillan, I think. grew up in like a Bible Belt kind of United States, and you know, parents watching all these kind of televangelists like Christian telly and all that, and he's made a really kind of dark fantasy version of that. So it's full of all these like biblical references, but you know, it's not that nice.
The story of the game is that Isaac, the character you're playing at, obviously an allusion to the biblical Isaac as well, his mum starts getting messages beamed into her for the telly saying it's God and saying that her son's a devil, she's got to kill him. So he escapes into this basement, but the basement's full of fucking horrible, disgusting creatures various symbolic meanings.
It's Tap Down Zelda, but you're a naked wee boy running about killing things with your tears.
Endorsed by the Catholic Church.
No, nothing to do with the Catholic Church, man. This one is skewering the evangelicals mostly. I think in a Catholic version, Isaac would be sexier.
The other thing I've been playing is a survival horror game, which has been getting a lot of praise recently, kind of indie game of the year type accolades last year, called Signalis. It plays very, very much like Resident Evil. It doesn't look like Resident Evil. It's got like pixel art backgrounds top down with like a 3D model on top of it, but all of your like conserving ammo, inventory management, like kind of slightly awkward movement that makes it scarier, all that stuff's in there. It does a really good job of it.
We're talking Ourezi, no, the fucking new action-packed stuff. The old, slightly clunky, scarier stuff, in my opinion.
Aye, 1-3 style Rezi. The puzzles are very much like Rezi. It's not quite tank controls, but probably as close as you can get away with in the modern day.
Aye.
It's set in a kind of sci-fi world. I'm still not 100% clear on what's going on in it, because you're kind of just flung in medias res, but there's a sci-fi world. It's allusions to some sort of like autocratic sort of society you get the impression that you're kind of walled off for like the main sort of galactic empire, and you're opposed to them. It's a society where there's humans, but there's also like robot clones of the humans, or like robot sort of replicas of them, and they kind of work together, and you're a robot trying to find your human on this space base. I think it's like a mining colony. But there's like a virus, and it's caused everyone to go mental and start fucking eating each other. So these things come around as, or go around as zombies that you've got to shoot.
So I'm getting it 9 out of 10 at the minute. Just tell me, do I look like Rutger Hauer for that final point?
You kind of look like a wee waifish anime lassie, so maybe take some points off for that, unfortunately.
Well, I don't know if you would take points off for that necessarily.
But yeah, there's cool stuff in it. There's an element where, like, if you go back to a room that you've been in before and you've killed the zombie could just come back after a certain number of turns, unless you kill it with a flare, and you get obviously very limited numbers of flares, so you've got to think, like, which ones are these do I want to get rid of permanently, and which ones can I just avoid?
That's in... I don't know if this was in OG Resi, but that was in the Resident Evil remake on a GameCube, for sure.
Okay.
At a certain point, you had to go and burn the corpses and the zombies that you'd done in earlier, or else they could come back.
Leagues.
Aye, the Crimson
Aye,
Leagues,
they were
it.
Bastards, man. That was one thing that was in the original, wasn't it? It was, you had to kill them twice, essentially.
I think it was a game, which for me is still the best Resi remake they've ever done, the old one. You were looking at two, Andy. I'm not into the 2 and 3 remakes and all that.
The thing is, I've recently played the second one, I get quite deep into it. I'm currently on a bit. Remember the bit where Hangman X fucking chases you?
So you're through a police station. You're into the lab and all that.
Aye. So I'm quite a bit into it, but into the first scenario. But what I noticed about it was Resident Evil 2 for the new consoles is still Resident Evil 2, in many senses of the word. The layout of the station is still the same. The main difference is that it's no longer. I know this is your favourite bit. It's no longer the perspectives, like the tank controls and the pre-rendered backgrounds. You're now fixed behind them in a third-person perspective. I prefer that, man, I'm not going to lie.
We'll differ there. And we also might differ here, just before we move on. Claire or Leon?
Leon.
Nah, get fuck. Claire CSC. Right. Speaking as you were a second ago about wee waifish anime lassies, McCormick, let's get on to our first game of the evening, which is Legend of Dragoon. This is a very anime game. Why did you pick it for myself?
So this is a game that I had growing up. I can't remember in which era of like Final Fantasies I was also playing at the time, but I think I was basically waiting for another Final Fantasy hit. And there wasn't a new game out at the time, so I'd seen this one advertised, heard it was meant to be a bit of a Final Fantasy killer, and played it. And I quite enjoyed it. I had fond memories of it, but I think there was something in the back of my mind saying it's not quite Final Fantasy though, is it? Like, and I was never quite sure if it was, if I was looking back at it and kind of being too hard on it or being too easy on it. So I wanted to kind of revisit it and maybe get a fresh pair of eyes on it and see what you thought of it.
I'm surprised this came out in PAL territories. I'm showing you that I've not done enough research there, to be honest.
Yeah.
It seems like a type of thing that we didn't usually get. I don't feel like we really got a lot of the JRPGs in the PS1, particularly these ones that you see creeping up on like hidden gems lists, as you do with this one.
So this was made by Skia. No, the charity, the African Catholic charity, the Sony Computer Entertainment America, one of their in-house studios, and you get the impression that they wanted to make like a kind of something that was going to reach some level of the success of Final Fantasy. So I think they had a decent kind of size budget for it, and I think they plugged it quite hard to get some success. But I don't know. I don't really know how well it sold in the end, really. I think this is probably a late period PlayStation game, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
Everything in this game strikes me as just a Final Fantasy VII clone. To the models, to the menus, to the pre-rendered backgrounds, everything just screams, this is trying to be Final Fantasy VII.
Well, you would be wrong there.
Ah.
I thought, going into this, I looked at the pre-rendered backgrounds, the flashy cutscenes and that, and I thought, right, aye, they've... Another studio's gone, Final Fantasy VII sold well, make a Final Fantasy VII. But you would be doing this game a disservice if you wrote it off like that.
Ah, okay.
I'll tell you, right, I love things like this. It was already on my radar. A good friend of the podcast, Leo Glaister, really rates this one, and he's been playing through it at the minute. So I had an inkling that maybe I would like it, and I did. It's PS1, right? The god of the JRPGs, probably. I feel that as I get older, you know, the world's a very cruel and dark place, and there's a certain wholesomeness and a purity to turning on a game and being a wee anime Japanese guy with spiky hair and sword, kicking about with all your pals, full of optimism and hope, you know, on some contrived quest to save the world.
Knowing that the battles probably aren't going to challenge you too much, and if they do, you can just spend enough time with it and you'll overcome those obstacles in your life.
Aye, definitely.
Or if you're me, spend all your days looking for the guy to kill your feather, but you don't get any resolution because they don't make any more games to you.
In this game, you're also looking for the guy that killed your dad, actually.
Yeah. We have got the disappearing dad trope, right? We got all the trimmings here. This is fully all your classic JRPG tropes. You see your protagonist's hometown get done in a flashback. His dad's a great warrior, and you're trying to get revenge on this thing called the Black Monster that killed your dad.
Is there about 15 endings?
No, I don't believe so.
That's an art trope of JRPGs.
The plot and the setting, they're no generic, right? There's enough to them that it's interesting enough, but you've got quite a standard Warring Kingdoms narrative, and you've got that JRPG trope, which a lot of people would know for Final Fantasy VI, where you've got an imperial power using an ancient and ruinous sort of form of power, a dangerous power, to try and advance their imperial goals. Final Fantasy VI, it's like magic summons, and this, it's dragons, which conveniently ties into the fact that our protagonist and his new pals have this kind of latent dragoon ability, which doesn't turn them into medieval Polish warriors, but instead... makes them these kind of anime dragon knights with, like, cool wings and that, complete with, like, over-the-top transformations.
Is it a wee bit like Panzer Dragoon Saga, then? Well, that was the same sort of idea, wasn't it? Like, custom...
No, this is much more of a traditional fare. It's, the setting is like the older Final Fantasies, or like a SNES RPG, is that kind of vibe about it. It's not trying to be cyberpunk or anything, it's very much a kind of medieval or early modern sort of setting.
Medieval with a wash of magic over it. Tolkien shit, basically.
Tolkien with spiky hair.
I would say the only thing in terms of Panzer Dragoon is when they do their transformation into the Dragoon characters, they get this cool looking kind of armour and these kind of dragonfly wings on them. And that's a wee bit kind of Panzer Dragoon Sega looking to me, at least. But basically nothing else about it gives you the kind of vibes.
Well, for me, that part was like Power Rangers or Sailor Moon or something.
Yeah, a bit like that as well.
Which, I mean, you can tell why this is the appeal to like a kind of teenage fucking fan of cartoons and that.
I liked the one cutscene probably quite near the start is where you get King Albert and he's got an advisor who's been alive for fucking donkeys for some reason, and he gives you a lore dump about an ancient war between humans and these guys that were like the slave masters of humans called Winglies. But as he's talking, and it's fully voice acted, the camera pans over this kind of tapestry. It tells you the whole story and shows you the war between them. I thought that was a really cool shot. It was quite cinematic. I was getting right into it. The characters in this are a wee bit one note, but they're pretty enjoyable. There's a big meat-headed sexist guy. There's a wee kind of healer lassie, spiky-haired, do-gooder protagonist in that. My favourite character was Rose, who only kind of recently joined my party. But she brought me back to my beloved Phantasy Star. We are sort of anime cat ears. I was like, oh, you're spoiling me here.
Aye, she's your kind of mysterious badass warrior character that's no doubt got some sort of tragic backstory that's left her cold and emotionless and guarded. Dart, your main guy, and Shanna is like his childhood, you know, childhood sweetheart sort of thing, but she's worried that like he only sees her as a friend. She might want something more. Lavitz, the kind of noble knight who I read is a kind of gay best pal. I don't know about you.
Well, they do the predator handshake. Did you get that bit? Aye.
What the fuck is the predator handshake?
You son of a bitch!
Oh right. Aye, that.
Come on, Andy, waking up here. I know you're just off a back shift, but for fuck's sake.
No excuse for that.
I got to the bit about 6 hours in, just after killing the dragon. The dragon that burnt the Tundun at the start and all that, where Lavitz just got his dragoon power up. Leo says later on, you get like this Ao man who's a kung fu master, and that he would probably be my favourite character, but I never got far enough to get him. I got maybe 6-7 hours in.
I've just got him. That's towards the tail end of the first disc. Aye. He has not, as of yet, learned about his dragoon nature. I'm sure he will, but until then he's slightly useless as a party member, so I've not been doing too much with him. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing if I do get any more folk, because I only actually played this as a wane up to the end of disc one, but there's fucking 4 discs, so who knows where it's going to go for there.
See, if it was Christmas 1996 or 97, right?
You would need to wait 5 years for this.
You'd be disappointed. Or
Is this game going to come out in 2001, did it?
Aye, as McCormick was saying, this is a wee bit later.
That doesn't look like a 2001 game, does it? That's crazy.
I'll jump ahead to my section on graphics then. I wanted to talk about the battle systems.
Right.
But you'll notice with this, they've spent a fucking couple of quid on these cutscenes. They are like near enough Squaresoft level. And outside of the cutscenes, the polygonal models for your characters are far from the worst I've seen. They actually look like people. They are far less like fucking, I don't know, Playmobil looking weird block guys and like Final Fantasy VII or something like that.
They animate quite well. They've got good wee effects for spells and stuff like that. The monsters kind of look good and kind of animate quite well as well. So yeah, I think they've spent a few bob on that side.
I mean, Final Fantasy VII was a lot older and had this as well, but the pre-rendered backgrounds in this are fucking really nice as well. That's probably the best graphical feature of it, in my opinion, but you're not going to get sick of looking at this one. It's, you know, it's nice. But aye, what I want to talk about, one of the main things that would set us apart for you is its battle system. You've got, it is a traditional turn-based combat, right? But Andy, and I think I've got an inkling you might like this, it's got the wee kind of kinetic touches that you get in something like Paper Mario, where you get different, you know, timed button presses for different attacks, or like button mashing to do more damage. Just wee extra things that adds a wee bit more interactivity into the fights to stop them forgetting just attack, 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 attack.
See, that's what changes these turn-based fights from just dealing cards to actually like participating in a hit.
It stops you from zoning out and just mashing the attack button, which, you know, as much as I like stuff like, you know, like the old Final Fantasy IV or something, you do get points where you're walking through a dungeon just going, attack, 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 right, fight over, attack, 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 attack. One thing I would say with Dragoon, I found the encounter rate a wee bit on the high side sometimes, so sometimes I probably could have just done with button mashing like fuck to get through some of these random battles.
Aye, although you do get the item that lets you like lower the encounter rate briefly, which I've never had enough of to like make loads of use of, but it is handy. Sometimes you just get fucking sick of the fights just to gob one of them.
I made good use of that.
There's a few things I like about the battle system. Things that, like, on paper don't seem like pure revolutionary, but actually they kind of synchronise together and work out quite well. Like, the fact that you can, you've got your Paper Mario style abilities, and you can also choose, like, for each character what sort of combo they're going to use. So you might have to, like, tap the button on time one, so you have to type it maybe 4 times in a row to get, like, the ultimate one. So based on how comfortable you are and how good you are at the rhythm sort of game, you can tailor it to how much risk you want to take doing that. There's also a thing where, like, you can't have, like, 99 potions or whatever. You're limited to the number of hands you carry, so you've got to be a bit clever about how many healing potions and how many attack magic and how many fucking, like, resurrection spells you have. And your defend also heals you, so that kind of gives you motivation to defend as well and not waste, like, one of your precious potions. So there's a few things that kind of... You've not got hundreds of options in battle, but the options are kind of... have a bit more depth to them than you might normally get.
The likes are defending for a turn, or even using items that they attack magic damage, are two features in Final Fantasy that you basically never fucking bother with.
Aye.
See, you get the items in Final Fantasy games, and it's like, oh, this does the same as like a fire spell. You're like, but I can do a fire spell. Why would I waste this? The fact that you've got to build up a meter to change into a dragoon to then be able to use magic sort of incentivizes you maybe more to use these wee attack magic items. And as you say, with the healing for defending, there's a lot of thought going into this. I don't think you can accuse it of being a cash grab Final Fantasy clone. I think they wanted to make something good. I think they tried when they made this.
Yeah, the Dragoon transformation is like an important part of the battle. You unlock more of these as you go on, and more characters get it. I'm at a point where, like, all my party that I've got, three or four of them, you can only get three in a party, but four characters have got these Dragoon spirits, and you can cast a thing where they all transform into it at once, and then you get a mad psychedelic background to the going on, which is pretty cool as well. I would say, though, that they maybe like the sort of magic animations a bit too much, because when you cast a spell in Dragoon form, it takes fucking ages to do the whole song and dance about the spell, much like Final Fantasy games did when you summoned, like, Knights of the Round or something. You can just sit and put the console down for 5 minutes and we come back when the spell's done.
Do you really need me to sit for 2 minutes every time I summon fucking Shiva?
Yeah,
it's the same
I've
with
seen
these
it.
Dragoon transformations. Like, you need to watch that whole animation every time.
First time you see it, it's fucking class, isn't it? You're like, oh my god. And then, like, an hour into a game, it's just like the 40th time it's played, man. You're like, fucking hell, man.
You can turn it off for the transformations and the settings, but you can't turn it off for the spells.
On the aesthetic side of things, we've talked a bit of graphics. The music's alright, I would say. Nothing to write home about. The wee battle themes get mixed up a wee bit so they don't get too monotonous, which I quite like. Although, I mean, I would struggle to think of many of them that left an impression. The only thing musically I could say that I particularly enjoyed was the wee menu tune. When you open the menu, it plays a jazzy wee tune, like sort of like an old Persona game or something, which I love.
Put me in mind a Massive Attack or something.
Bit of music I wanted to flag just quickly was that at the beginning of the game you get a cutscene where the baddies, you know, burn down the toon, and, you know, the dragons attacking and they kidnap Wee Shanna and all that, and there's loads of people running about dying and it's all chaos, and, like, the music playing during that sounds like background music for Wii Sports or something. It's really ill fitting.
You wonder if that was written for another part of the game and it was just like, oh fuck, I need to put it in here for another songs.
It didn't really nail down the stakes for me, do you know what I mean? But aye, overall, I would say this is well worth your time if you're a JRPG guy, particularly if you love that kind of PS1 era. For me, in terms of other, like, PS1 hidden gem RPGs we've looked at, I probably wouldn't say this is as good as Xenogears or Suikoden 2. As you were saying, in terms of the PlayStation Final Fantasies, okay, it's maybe not as good as them, but I would say if you find yourself replaying them a lot and you've not looked at a lot outside of them, this is a great place to start, probably. Very solid presentation, engaging enough wee story, plenty of depth in the combat. Aye, this is heavy decent.
Aye, it's not a particularly intimidating one, I wouldn't say. It's not spreadsheet hell. Like, you're probably going to have a fairly easy time getting into it if you're curious about RPGs.
If you're good at the wee button-tapping elements of it, that's probably more important than working out good battle strategies. Do you know what I mean?
If you can complete Parappa the Rapper, you have no danger with this.
The rhythm in this actually seems to work. So, maybe not a like for like. But aye, there we go. Legend of the Dragoon. Enjoyed it. Let's move on to your next game of the episode. Andy, why did you pick Ogre Battle 64 for Mr. McCormick?
I've got pure vivid memories of McCormick playing tactical RPGs, and he's played one or a couple on his show as well. So, man, N64 isn't known for its RPGs, or real-time strategy games, or the like, so I thought, I'll see what I can do, and I'll look at N64 and see if I can find something that would fit Mick's profile, and I think this is it. So, aye, how did you get on with it?
Aye, so this is another kind of slow-burning one, I would say, one that I wasn't entirely sure what I was doing, and it took me a while to find my feet, but I have eventually got there with it, and I've been quite enjoying it. So, this is Ogre Battle 64, Person of Lordly Calibre, part of a series of games by a team called Quest, who are a kind of small developer. They had a few games that they came out, again, in NES and SNES era, one of the big hits, but then they struck it reasonably successful with the first Ogre Battle game, which is called Ogre Battle March of the Black Queen. Ogre Battle and March of the Black Queen are both Queen songs, back when Queen were more of a heavy metal band than a pop juggernaut headlining Live Aid and that. The folk that made the game are big fans of British rock band Queen, Freddie Mercury, and they sprinkle a lot of different references to their songs in their game titles. I was just kind of laughing to myself imagining they put out a game called Ogre Battle Fat Bottomed Girls or Ogre Battle Bohemian Rhapsody, that sort of thing. If the company didn't go defunct, that maybe that's what they'd be putting out now. So what Tactics Ogre was quite a unique kind of blend of classic JRPG, where you've got characters that you're leveling up, different classes and that sort of thing, but also a real-time strategy game, something like a Warcraft or a Dune 2, that sort of thing. So you get characters that are kind of moving about the map in real time, and then when a character meets an enemy, it goes into like a JRPG battle that runs automatically. You don't really get much control over what happens in it. Your guys are using skills and abilities and stuff to fight each other.
It's Shining Force style rather than... Well, not quite Shining Force style, but closer to that than like a Final Fantasy Tactics or like Disgaea or something like that.
Yeah, so with this game, I would use the term strategy RPG rather than tactics RPG. Strategy being like the bigger picture of a war or a battle, because we're talking about like big armies like going down the road, capturing a stronghold. Like, it's more that kind of scale as opposed to tactical game where it's like a squad, small squad in a small confined location, scrapping on the streets. It's more of a kind of grand scale. So yeah, that game was reasonably successful. After that, there was a sequel called Tactics Ogre. Tactics Ogre is a tactics game, as I was talking about. This is more small scale. You've got more control over each individual unit in your party. So the guy that was in charge of both of these games, Yasumi Matsuno, he got headhunted by Square, who were a much bigger operation than Quest. I'm not sure the exact story behind it, but you get the impression that he would have a much bigger budget behind him if he went for Square. It seemed like the right move for him at the time. And he went on to make Final Fantasy Tactics, which we all know and love. So Tactics Ogre, I've not really played Tactics Ogre. I'm definitely going to go back to it because it basically seems that what he done was he took that game and he gave it a bit of a Final Fantasy spin. He took a lot of mechanics, stuff at that game added chocobos effectively, and that's Final Fantasy Tactics for you. But after he left, the quest soldiered on regardless, and they made a sequel to the first game of the series, Tactics Ogre March of the Black Queen, and this one was called Person of Lordly Calibre, which isn't a Queen song, just sounds cool. One interesting thing that Quest are known for Willard games is that, as opposed to a lot of JRPGs at the time, their stories are quite dark and the stories are also quite political. If you remember when we talked about Final Fantasy Tactics, there was a lot of class antagonism and like secret histories and class consciousness and stuff like that.
Aye.
This game is no exception. And I was trying to place, it's a story of like a revolution against a corrupt monarch and that sort of thing. And I was trying to place what historical influence this game was based on, because a lot of their games have parallels to the real world. But I don't know, maybe
English Civil War bits and pieces. You get a bit of that of Final Fantasy Tactics, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. So I'll try and describe this, and you can see where I theorise that they've taken inspiration from. So before the plot starts, there's a large kind of state starts forming under the rule of a kind of new religious movement, which is a monotheistic religion, and the head of state and the head of government are one and the same. They become a really powerful, technologically advanced empire, and they invade a neighbour who is much less technologically advanced. It's more of a kind of a clan system. They're quite a remote place, and what they do is they take over that country and they institute feudalism in a class system. They impose that onto them, but they make sure that the people from the original country, from the big empire with their own religion, are always the upper class. They're an ascendancy, if you will.
A Protestant ascendancy, you might say.
You've got it. You've got where I'm going with this, right? You play as a character many generations later, a guy called Magnus. He was pals growing up with one of the younger princes, and his dad foiled an assassination attempt on the younger prince, but due to complicated political reasons, wasn't he meant to do that. The assassination was kind of a conspiracy that was planned for the start, so he gets strung up, he gets framed for the murder of the prince, even though he defended him. Magnus goes off and he joins the military academy, learns to be a knight, and then he is sent to the southern provinces, kind of backwater provinces, to kind of live out his days in the army, commanding an army in the south. But what happens there is there's a lot of class antagonism. Everyone is really upset with the sort of shite way that the lower classes have been treated, the sort of way that the nobles just seem to be able to do what they want. There's a lot of inequality.
They're serfs, basically, I take it.
Yeah, so a revolution starts brewing. A revolutionary army is formed, and they kind of rise up. The rising is not particularly popular. You speak to people in the towns, in the country, they're like, why are they doing this? This is why they're causing trouble. This is ridiculous. But you end up, as part of your army, capturing the head of the rebellion, and he is killed without a trial.
Their blood sacrifice leads to a resurgent popularity in republicanism and a subsequent war, which is more successful.
That is exactly what happens, yeah.
Genuinely, aye.
Yeah. That initial rebellion is put down, but then because of the horrible way that they're treated, you know, suddenly everyone is like, you know, I didn't agree with them in the first place, but that was the way you responded to that was completely out of line. So yeah, a much bigger rebellion happens in your character.
Do you think they've consciously done Britain and Ireland, or like are we connecting dots? Because the way you're describing it sounds like this is a conscious choice.
So I'm maybe like bending this narrative very slightly, but all the main points are there. Like, so I think in the fact that these guys have made a game, like for example, the sequel to the Tactics Ogre was based on the fucking wars in Yugoslavia and Bosnia. Like, these guys know about their history, so aye. I mean, I wouldn't be entirely surprised if they took influence for that. There's other, you know, anti-colonial sort of struggles as well, but you can read into it. But for me, it definitely reminded me a lot of Ireland. You've also got folk in the revolution that are kind of, you know, some of them are more like socially orientated. They want to overthrow the ruling class, but there's also a nationalist element as well, because there's this big empire and they want to declare independence for this empire. So you've got those kind of two...
You've got your citizens' army and your volunteers.
Yeah, you've got those two conflicting urges. So how this plays out is effectively the same as I described the first game. So you are managing like squads, like a number of squads, up to 10 that you can put out in the field at any given time. Although in practice it gets a bit unwieldy to do that. I've been using about 4. And the squad has like 5 characters in it. One leader, usually like a hero sort of named character.
Aye.
And then 4 others of various classes. And as I said, when they get into battles, you can't pick exactly what they do, but based on the formation, if they're in the back row, the middle row, or the front row, they get different moves.
You've got Magnus, and you're in a squad with a couple of fellas, right? Say one of them's called Jimmy the Wizard. You get into an altercation with the baddies, and one of them kills Jimmy the Wizard. Is Jimmy the Wizard dead, or does he come back next time? Can you revive him and all that?
So mid-battle, you can revive folk. If you go to one of the wee strongholds and it's got a witch's den in it, you can revive them. If you don't revive them by the end of the battle, they turn into a zombie. And the zombies actually have like the whole AIN class system and everything. It's just a completely different type of character.
Right.
So you can have a full zombie army if you want to, but I found that quite interesting. Not permadeath in the same way that you got in Final Fantasy Tactics. I'm going to be comparing this to Final Fantasy Tactics a lot because it's quite illuminating.
What if a zombie dies?
If a zombie dies, he just can come back to life. Right. But they're never going to be as powerful as a human. There's a lot of prep involved in like making sure that your squads are laid out in a sensible way. You maybe get your wizards, but you've got like soldiers in front of them, knights in front of them to protect them for damage. You make sure everyone's got the right equipment and stuff like that. I had a selection of units. I had like an all-female one. I had one that had like wizards and a couple of monsters as well. You can have things like dragons and pixies and things, and they've got their own class system as well. And you send those out to battle, and then each squad you're kind of controlling across the map. You can send folk out to take over strongholds and to fight other enemies. And then they'll get into kind of JRPG-style battles with the other enemy troops, and it lasts a fixed amount of time, these battles, so you won't necessarily wipe out one side or the other. Just lasts a certain amount of time, and then the winner keeps on going on his path, and the loser kind of runs away.
I'm going to bring back a McCormickism from an earlier episode. You intimated in the chat that this game is maybe more a grower than a shower, that at first you didn't really think that much of it. And you played it for a wee while, and you get more into it as you played. Is this due to the way that it sort of reveals more complex strategies and things as you go on? Or do you think just the fights get more interesting, or the plot advanced a wee bit more?
So, there's a few things. So, I think from like reading the instructions and the tutorial and stuff, you got the impression that the main thing that you had to do to win in these battles was strategic. It was about making sure that your soldiers are in the right place at the right time, making sure that you've got like a right type of unit that's going to counter a certain other type of unit, so that you might not be stronger, but you'll have the advantage because you've got the fucking strategic know-how, or that you've done like a big fucking amazing flanking maneuver or an ambush or something like that. That's the sort of thing I was thinking in my head, like how I'm going to win these battles against the odds. But I'm realizing through playing it that the RPG stuff, the fucking managing your party, equipping your party, leveling folk up in that, that's how you win battles. Like, there is some strategic elements, like flanking can be important. Being in a stronghold puts you in a better position than being out in the field, stuff like that. Fatigue as well, like if you're guys walking for too long, they have to camp, and then if the enemy attacks you when you're camped, you're fucked because you're asleep. And they get the jump on you. So there's some strategic elements, but I found myself basically winning most battles just in a straight lineup with the enemy, because mine had been levelled more and they'd better swords, shit like that. So that was slightly disappointing, and I think I was fielding so many folk on the battlefield, and I also had like all of the battle animations and stuff turned on, that it just turned into a big slog. Like the fights were taking fucking ages, like the levels were taking forever, and it felt really slow. But when I paired my mob down to like 4 different units, and got them kind of leveling up, like, because obviously if you get less of them and they're doing more fights, then they're getting more experience, so there's less folk at play, but they're more powerful, they're more effective. So I found myself zipping through the levels a bit faster and getting a bit more invested in it, and getting a bit more invested in unlocking new classes and being able to develop my army much in the way you would in Final Fantasy Tactics, where you've got an idea that you might want certain classes on the go, and kind of doing all the micromanagement of the army became a bit more satisfying once I understood what the game actually wanted for me.
Andy, did you manage to get a shot of this yourself?
I played this back today. I'm not going to lie, man. I rented it and fucking couldn't work it out and hated it. But I knew that was usually the thing. If I got a game that I couldn't really play and I never really got far in, the chances are my comment would probably like it. So that was the same sort of fucking thinking here. I saw all the numbers and all the fucking moving about and grids and all that, and I was like, I'm just going to love this, man.
Teletext Simulator.
Aye.
Yeah, it's something that I think I'm going to be playing for a bit of a while longer, just to kind of get more of a feel for it, because it's taken me a wee while to kind of reel itself. But what I've heard about it, it gets quite interesting. You know, the battles start off reasonably easy, but I can feel them ramping up a wee bit now, and I might have to be forced into using a bit more strategy than I was before. You get loads of different classes that you unlock. I think that's kind of the bread and butter of this game, is like leveling your guys up. The class system makes a wee bit more sense than Final Fantasy Tactics did, I find anyway, because once you've got like the equipment for a certain class, like a certain type of armour, then anyone can become one if they have the right stats. Like, so you can be a knight if you've got enough strength in that. But if you're leveling up your character as a certain class, then you'll get certain stats. So it encourages you to go up from like a basic soldier, then you're getting more strength, enough strength to become a knight, and then you level up, you get enough strength to become someone else. Kind of encourages you doing the path of like one character's going to probably be a fighter type character rather than a wizard type character and that. But you don't have to, like you did in Final Fantasy Tactics, if you want the ninja, you don't have to go through all the shite, useless jobs like fucking thief and archer and all that before you get the good stuff.
Get 6 levels in this and 4 levels in that.
They don't have quite the sort of variety of like abilities to differentiate them, because at the end of the day, you're not actually controlling them in battles. Like, they do fight themselves. But there are some fun ones. Apparently later in the game, you can get vampires and they can only move at night, which is quite cool. During the day, they sleep in a coffin. And then, yeah, there's like a puppet master class that I've got. He fucking sends puppets out to fight. One of the best ones is meant... Yeah, that's quite cool, and the puppets are suitably creepy. We've ventriloquist dummy guys. All of the classes are split by gender, which is maybe a bit outdated. But like, you get like Valkyries or like female warriors, or knights or like male ones, that sort of thing.
I like that your army sounds quite evil. You know, you've got fucking zombies and monsters and these weird puppet masters and vampires and stuff. I take it the baddies are just the same as well.
Yeah, you start off just fighting kind of normal humans, but it ends up there's like fucking creatures for the underworld and all sorts of stuff like that. There's a weird alignment system, which apparently is like pure broken, and like you could basically encourage to cheat your way around it, because it makes a load of kind of doesn't make sense how you end up with like characters of a certain alignment. But that leads into the classes as well. So like the lich and the vampire and stuff, they're like evil alignment. You have to be evil to get those units. But you can have some good units and some evil units, and then have a mix and match of like, you know, angelic guys and demonic guys, and there's different endings as well based on your main character's alignment. The story of the game, I say I'm not particularly far in it. I've kind of just like realised the error of my ways in the army, and I'm fighting with a rebellion. But Final Fantasy Tactics, I'm comparing again, that kind of dinghies the class warfare stuff to an extent and starts being about evil churches and resurrecting the Dark Messiah and stuff like that. Whereas reading just a summary of the story of this game, it appears that you basically start the revolution, you bring the revolution to different parts of the world. There are kind of supernatural elements to it, but at the end of the day, what you're doing is like storming the capital and implementing a new government.
Aye, you're out to kill the Tsar. You're not out to find the 7 doodads of mystical power.
Aye, and like based on your alignment, apparently determines whether in the ending like you become the new ruler, or if you're so chaotic, like all your other revolutionaries are like basically, you're too hardcore to be put in charge of anything. You've got too much bloodlust. Like, your place is in the battlefield. You're not going to be a ruler after this. See you later. which is an interesting twist in your usual like good and bad endings.
I liked the graphical style from the wee screenshots you sent in the chat.
Yeah, so there's pre-rendered backgrounds in this, which you see like when people are duking out on the battlefield, but they've also got a wee bit of animation as well, like kind of grass blowing, or like if you're in a wee town, there'll be like a wee wooden sign blowing in the wind sort of thing. So it adds a wee bit extra to your usual Final Fantasy style pre-rendered backgrounds. And the character graphics are pre-rendered, similar to like Donkey Kong Country type pre-rendered 3D, but for my money, they're a bit more well-defined, they're a bit more colourful, they kind of you can kind of see everything quite well, so it's a good example of that kind of style. I know we all have kind of sprites here, but this is kind of a decent example of that. So yeah, it all kind of goes together. Doesn't it look a lot like an N64 game to me? I always associate N64 with like, that particular style of blocky 3D.
It's an absolute fleshy growth on the neck of the N64. That's a horrible fucking analogy, mate, but that's what it was. It was like, it was like, what are you doing here? What you doing? You're no N64 at all, so what are you doing? And maybe that's like...
Too handsome, son. You sure you're not a PlayStation game?
Aye, it doesn't shout N64 in any way at all, does it, really?
Yeah, and it's interesting because they also developed Tactics Ogre on the PlayStation. Well, it was originally a SNES game, but yeah, you wonder why they chose N64 for this and PS1 for the other one.
If this was on the PS1, do you think that people would talk about it more as like this hidden gem thing? But because everybody just writes off role-playing games on the N64, outside of Zelda, which, okay, you can make an argument if that even is one, nobody really thinks of the N64 for these type of games. Do you think people would talk about this more in terms of a hidden gem if it was on the PS1? Do you think more people would have played it?
So, the argument against that is that the game that did come out in the PS1, Tactics Ogre, wasn't particularly successful. However, I definitely do think that because the PS1 had, like, more of a built-in audience for these type of games, like, if you like Final Fantasy, you're going to buy a PlayStation and you're probably going to buy more RPGs, whereas if you're not interested in RPGs, then you'd be much more likely to buy an N64 and conversely not play this. I think they probably did blunder in, like... In terms of, like, technical capacities of it, like, I don't see why they couldn't have pulled this game off in the PS1.
But the way I see it is, like, if you're just blasted through the Islet system, you've taken down fucking Andros, and you're saying, right, what am I playing next? There's near a better way to tear the shirt right off your chest than to put on a tactical RPG, in my opinion. But I know we're all different.
That's what makes the world beautiful. Yeah, going from fifth gear to first gear, your engine's going to blow up.
Well, I mean, what else are you... Is anything going to stand up to Lilac Wars, you know what I mean?
Possibly.
Are you better off running about being a daft bear in a gumdrop world? Or being Mario in a go-kart, do you know what I mean?
I like the Rogue Squadron games, man. I thought they kind of scratched the itch a wee bit. Not much, but a wee bit, you know. But that's a different story, isn't it, for another day.
So yeah, to sum up here, if you're an RPG pervert, I've said this before, this is one for you. If you really do like micromanaging a big load of characters, if you've ever played an RPG and you've had to tinker with people's skills and tinker with people's swords, and you've thought, right, I've done this with 4 folk, how about I do this with like 30 folk, then this is probably the game for you. If you're a massive real-time strategy head, I would say maybe not. This is maybe would lead you under false pretenses. There is the odd element of strategy to it, but it's more of an RPG.
Is it a baby's first?
I mean, it's like fucking adult's last RPG and baby's first strategy game combined. But yeah, I'm going to play a bit more of it. I'm interested in the connections with Final Fantasy Tactics, which I love, which means I'm probably also going to have to play Tactics Ogre, which is like even more similar to Final Fantasy Tactics. Like a lot of the stuff that I thought was like made, just brought in like for whole cloth in Final Fantasy Tactics, pretty much comes for these games. Like all the stuff about fucking Zodiacs and all the stuff about like complicated politics and fucking feudalism and class struggle and all that. This is all here. So if you like that stuff, you'll be into these games.
There's a whole tarot card thing in the games as well, isn't there? Or is that, like, older Ogre Battle games?
Yeah, the first Ogre Battle thing has, like, a a tarot card system. You kind of play these tarot cards that affect the run of the battle. That's not in this one, although you do get something that you got in the first Ogre Battle game, which I really like, which is you get like a series of questions that you're asked at the start to kind of create your character, and that kind of determines what kind of character you are in that. I do quite like that.
I always like that, and yeah, you might get that in your game next time as well, who knows. Right, that brings us on to our final game of the episode. For Mr. Andy Mack, I've picked Strider. Basically, as I said, this to me felt like a blind spot in the Bulgin's Sega-centric worldview. I think you've played most of the big hitters for Sega. You're well through most people's wee piles, but I never really hear you talking about Strider. And this one for me has always been a bit of a wild ride. That whole futuristic Eurasian weirdness about it. You've got giant robots, you've got dinosaurs, you've got all this mad shit in it. So I just wanted to see how you got on with it.
Aye. See, blind spot, I have been aware of Strider. I have been aware of it. As you said, you mentioned the wee pile analogy. This was in every wee pile, it seemed, back in the day. It's got one of the most iconic Sega Mega Drive cases of all time. John Claude Van Damme doing a fucking, some sort of turrican kick, whatever the fuck you call it. He's got a roundhouse kick. The thing he does at the fucking Kumite tournament. The roundhouse thing, where he makes a point of like moving his leg after it. Keanu Reeves does it in Matrix Day.
Aye,
it's so cool. But that sort of sets the tone for what you've got. Absolute fucking mayhem and chaos. And before I go into what the game's actually about, I'm going to talk a wee bit about the background of the game, what it actually is. So, it's a Capcom game. It's not a Sega game. It's originally for the arcade system. It's called the CP system. It's Capcom's own sort of arcade board. At the time, they were shifting from the older boards that had kind of 8-bit looking games to games that we would recognise as looking kind of 16-bit. So you had games like Street Fighter 2 coming out. You had games like Final Fight. Games like Ghouls and Ghosts as well, that looked really good. They were really dynamic.
This is a really early example of, it didn't look exactly like the arcade. See, when you go to him and you put a cartridge in or whatever, right? It wasn't like for like, but this was when it started getting really fucking close.
This is the point I was going to make. The CP system, the arcade board, was quite similar in architecture to the Sega Mega Drive. They used the same GPU, Motorola 68000s, which meant that the Mega Drive could handle the sort of nuts and bolts of the game. Alright, it didn't have quite the same kind of resolution, colour depth, and on-screen colour availability. Sprites were a wee bit smaller, etc. Perhaps the frame rate kind of suffered a bit because of the detail they went into the sprites and things like that. But this is one of the games, along with Golden Axe, that's often cited as having a better port for the Mega Drive than it was for the arcade.
Aye.
There's various reasons for that. For instance, when you play the game, you don't know what to expect. It just loads up. You get that iconic Sega screen followed by Strider. And you're thrown into this level that's set in, am I right in thinking it's fucking the Kazakh SSR?
It's Astana, which is the capital of Kazakhstan. But the game incorrectly predicts that in 2049 there will be a Soviet Union. Unfortunately, there is not. But Strider flies in on this mad futuristic glider thing.
Aye.
You get Russian writing that says Astana and then CCCP, which obviously was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
You never know, though. Still 25 years.
Well, hopefully it comes back.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, you've got a pure racist film with Sacha Baron Cohen about Kazakhstan that just doesn't exist. This is like the other end of the spectrum.
In the lore of Strider, the Master is this alien from like the third moon of Jupiter or some shite like that. It's in one of the cutscenes. He comes to Earth and he takes over the Soviet Union initially and then takes over all other countries. But for some reason, he moves Earth's capital to Astana in the Kazakh SSR. So the first level, Strider, well, his name actually is the Strider, he's called Hiryu, and he is a Strider.
Sure.
Striders are a... They're a...
Ninja?
Either a secret organisation of, like, ninja assassins for Japan, who are one of the last holdouts against this alien warlord's control over Earth. But yeah, you fly into Astana and you'll get into this, but among other things, you fight the Congress of the Soviet Union, who jump off the benches and turn into a giant robot millipede, which attacks you with a hammer and sickle.
I like that.
Which is fucking tremendous.
The forces in this are quite cool, but the way it works is, it's just like, if you imagine an arcade game like Golden Axe or Alien Force. Was it Alien Storm?
Aye,
that sort of thing. It's just, same idea here. It's either a projectile, you've got a thing called a cipher. It's like a kind of hammer type of thing, like a cipher. Like, what's it called? A metallic hook.
A big laser sword.
Aye. And you can get, you basically use that to rip through baddies. You can get power-ups that make it more powerful, make it bigger, etc. And you use that to sort of rip your way through a level. There's not much in the way of projectiles in this game. It's just, you've got this thing. And I kind of likened it to the Castlevania kind of thing, where it's more a wee thing that comes at you rather than something you're shooting.
Aye, you get whip power-ups and stuff. Strider, in my head I call him Strider, because I played this when I was a Wayne, and when you were a Wayne, he wasn't called Hiryu, he was just called Strider.
It's the Blade Runner problem.
Strider's quite acrobatic, you know, you're flipping about, you're climbing, you're grappling a lot, you're hanging from a roof.
Right, so you've got 8 different directions you can move in, you can go... That's the thing that kind of made me worry when I started playing Strider, was the jump. Like, they've engineered it so that it's difficult, you've got to master it. It being an arcade game, you can jump on the spot, but you can't move in any direction when you jump. So you've got to...
No change in midair.
Nah,
you are...
Nah.
Once you get into that arc, you're finishing it.
Nah, we don't like that in the towers, do we? We like to be able to move about when we're jumping.
Generally, I like to be able to change direction when I'm jumping, just because it's established in games. Mm-hmm. It might not make sense in terms of the laws of physics, but it's what we're used to. However, sometimes an arc jump is done for a good reason. I don't know if necessarily in Strider you can say it is.
I mean, you get used to it. I mean, the game is so fast-paced, it doesn't really give you a choice, to be honest with you. You rip through these levels at some pace. There's so many on-screen baddies, it's amazing how much your Mega Drive is working here in order to keep the game running as smoothly as it does. Things exploding left, right and centre. You're running at some speed. Scenarios are popping up before your eyes. There's like mini sub-bosses to the point where your sub-bosses sort of become just normal enemies at one point. There's that much happening on the screen. It's just scenario after scenario. Game doesn't let up.
I think for something made in the 80s, they've really gone for... I mean, okay, it's a generic platformer where you're an acrobatic sword guy, but really it's about these mad like set pieces. Like the second level, you go to Siberia and there's a cutscene that sets up that this robot bounty hunter is going to come after you, and you fight him on top of a mountain, and when you kill him, you race down this mountain, there's all these explosions happening.
Aye.
And you have to like jump off at the bottom at the perfect... Aye, it's class.
It's got that thing where enemies will just keep spawning if you stand in one spot. Like, you can't kill all the enemies on the screen, they'll just keep fucking coming because they'll just keep repopulating, essentially. It kind of reminds me of the Davey Splatterhouse games. Remember them?
Aye,
we talk about them quite often on the podcast.
Super Star Wars.
Aye, sort of Star Wars too, same sort of thing. But I mean, once you work out to jump, you're sort of all over the screen, you're doing backflips, you're jumping up and down, you're grabbing onto things. One of the cool things about this game is that you can hold on to the walls, and you can hold on to like the roof and swing and kind of climb up them as well, and you can maneuver these to solve puzzles within the levels. For instance, one of the puzzles is these rotating blocks, some of which you've got jaggy hangs on them, some of which haven't, and you've got to try and look at the background assets to decide like where the path of progression is, and it's just trial and error. But this is how you figure out your acrobatic abilities early on in the game, by just trying everything. And by about halfway through the game, you realise that you can sort of climb, jump and manoeuvre yourself and slide in order to kind of use the background assets to your advantage, and it becomes quite exciting.
Andy, as I say to you, this is something I managed to beat on original hardware.
Mm.
Normal difficulty mode, I'd set it to like 5 lives, obviously. This is, the real heeds will know, you put up an Omega Drive game, don't just hit start, go into options and see if you can turn your lives up. Always a fucking must.
That's what I do. Again, obviously, you can do that in this. I mean, this completing these games always lives and dies by how many lives you've got, obviously, because, I mean, if you're running out of lives and continues, then you just got to go back to the beginning and it can become insufferable after a while. But, I mean, a lot of this game is left up to chance. For instance, the level where you get to the part where the level kind of blacks out and it kind of silhouette and random fucking electricity comes on screen, and there's no rhyme or reason to it until you play it 5 or 6 times and work it out.
It's no random.
I know it's not, but at first it does look that way.
It shoots in 4 different directions.
Aye.
And it's always in the same place.
It takes you a few lives to work that out though, man. By that time you fucking use the continue and you're like less than halfway through the game, you know.
What I was going to say is, what I remembered for playing it yesterday was that the way to do it as power-ups.
Yeah.
Get the wee robots, because they give you extra shield.
Yeah.
They run about and kill baddies for you.
I did like
Get the robot panther, if you can. Did you find him?
I know, but I did like how ubiquitous the level, the power-ups were. For instance, like getting health, you weren't just stuck with like one part of health. You were always one or two far away for another wee bit of health coming for you. But at the same time, there's that many projectiles coming your way, you were always reminded that this is a difficult arcade game. And it was going to be relentless. Even when you get to the airship, shit starts getting real, man, where you think you're almost at the end of the level, and then a big cannon that does nothing in the background starts shooting at you, and then you hit the cannon and it opens up this big labyrinth inside the fucking level.
You just completely destroy it and about half of the roof of the airship with one hit.
Then you're in the airship and you've got to jump on these platforms, but if you don't jump on the correct platforms at the right time, you'll fall through pits of death. And pits of death are one of my gripes with this game. I fucking hate them. I know they're a necessary evil, but they are quite ubiquitous in this game.
Strider has a couple of big fuck yous to the player, and the airship level is probably the worst offender. Fake out grunts that just drop you into the sky. The ones that I hated the most are, these are in Sonic as well, but Sonic doesn't do this. Do you know those kind of launcher things for like flying batteries on? And Strider, they just kill you. Strider, they don't do anything except kill you.
I was thinking it was just going to propel me to a new bit of level, but you're deep before you even fucking know it, man. You're deep.
I mean, you're a guy that's just jumped onto the outside of a giant plane.
This is it.
This is kind of par for the course. You should really have expected that.
There was some jobby bits, man. Let's see the bit where you've got to climb up the wall and the wall's closing in on you.
You don't climb it, you jump side to side.
You've got to get it to perfection. Another bit I found a bit jobby was, and this is a thing that's I can't remember the last time this happened in a game to me, but you can actually get timed out.
Aye.
So you get 2 minutes to finish your level, and when your time gets to zero, that is you, no matter what your progress is.
That's an arcade hangover, innit?
That's an outhang, innit? You don't get that anymore. You'd be fucking raging.
Aye, it makes nae sense. I'm sitting in my house, you're no trying to get me to put another 20p into this.
Mm.
I have bought this, do you know what I mean?
Aye.
Let me have more than 2 minutes to fuck about in a level, please.
I did enjoy the airship boss, man. It fucks about with gravity. I really did like this bit.
I like that.
They all gravity changing in games is something that can either live or die by what's actually going on around you as well. Sometimes it's just done for the sake of it. One minute you're on the roof, next minute you're on the ground, and there's no real rhyme or reason as to why it's happening. And that's the way it kind of was previous to the boss in the airship level, but when you get to the boss, you see what it's actually trying to do.
I usually quite like it. I like it in Sonic 3, I like it in Rocket Knight. I like it in Strider, but I like what you're talking about, that it's actually a sub-boss in the airship level that's got its own orbit. It acts a bit like a planet, doesn't
it? I like it. It reminds me of, I don't know if you've played the new Sonic game, Sonic Superstars, no?
No, I haven't.
It kind of, you're using the gravity of an object in order to speed yourself up and get momentum so that you can fling yourself.
Like orbit?
Aye. And it's all about timing it. And I thought that was quite fucking cool. And in a straightforward arcade platformer, they're trying this kind of crazy way to beat a boss. It looks fucking good too. It reminded me of the Xenomorph from Echo the Dolphin.
Aye.
It looked fucking class.
Did you get to the Amazon with those weird like tribal women that use those speech samples where I don't know what the fuck they're saying?
I say the Nudie Woman. They're running a bit mental, man. I like them. And sort of, I think the game, after the airship level, which I thought was fucking epic, this was a wee bit of a come down this level, I thought. You were swinging about like Tarzan on fucking or George of the Jungle. On, like,
I don't know, but you do get to dinosaurs after like that. You get a ride on a dinosaur, like pterodactyls flying, and then you fight a robot dinosaur at the end there.
I absolutely creamed everywhere, man. Pardon my French. When I seen that big dinosaur, the dinosaur sprite is that big. It doesn't even fit on the fucking screen. You've got to walk to the right for a good what, 2 seconds, 3 seconds before you can see the full splendour of this Diplodocus, man. It's absolutely fucking beautiful.
Did you make it to the master?
I got to see the level after that, where you're sort of on.
That's the final level. After that level, then you go on one of the airship things and you fly up and you basically just fight a master. And weirdly, his sprite is this. Do you know, when you start Strider, the master flies up on the screen and goes,
aye.
He just looks the same as that.
Aye, don't cool, man, keeping it ill. But this game sort of becomes, in the end, when you're sitting there and you've got used to it and you know how it works, the game just becomes an endurance test where you look at the top of the screen more than anything else. You look at how many lives you've got and how much life you've got left and the time you've got left, and you're always thinking about how many continues have I got? Because you know you're going to take hits, you know you're going to die loads, but you're thinking, right, I'm going to die loads, so I need to think about if it's feasible to keep going here with the continues I have, because the likelihood is I'm going to lose all my continues if I don't have enough, and then is it really worth investing my time to get deep into a game and I'm not going to have enough continues to beat what's going to inevitably be a fucking horrible final boss?
I don't think that it's a fair game. I don't think that the controls and things like that necessarily hold up that well. I think it's solid enough. There are far worse games on the platform than it. For me, what I really like about Strider is that it's this explosion of kind of childlike wonder. It takes you back to what games were when you were a Wayne, where there was just always something fucking mad going on. Like, aye, there's an airship, there's a giant robot, alright, there's dinosaurs in this level. It's just a kind of fuck it, why no approach.
The airship level fucking just was brilliant. I thought it was great.
Aye.
And that kind of made the game for me. I liked the fact that I sat and played that and I completed it on my own doing, with no fucking save scumming, no nothing. I played it on my EverDrive on my real hardware, and I fucking beat that level, man, sitting up on my cathode ray tube telly.
I've got to admit, my favourite level's still the Kazakh SSR. You fight Dolph Lundgren and all that.
I thought you might like that, aye, that's your favourite kind of thing. But I did enjoy it. Interesting history as well, as we were talking about the arcade system earlier on. This game is ported to fucking everything, apparently.
There's weird C64, Speccy, there is an NES port, which is actually quite good, which is a totally fucking different game. It's like a puzzle-y kind of platformer thing where you've got to use different items and stuff like that.
It was on weird things like the Atari ST, the Amstrad CP fucking C, that thing that's just blue and green.
There is also a fake Strider 2 that Capcom had nothing to do with.
One of my most disappointing global video rentals I can ever remember was Strider 2. It was a fucking, I don't know if it was fucking US gold or something, but what a downgrade, man. It felt like, I don't know, it was, horrendous. They made a proper Strider 2 as well on the PS1, which is pretty good, and they also made a reboot type game in 2014, which got kind of decent reviews as well. It's come back in a few guises over the years, but it wasn't really a mainstay for Capcom in the way that like a Mega Man was or in.
I think the bold Hiryu is popular enough in Japan. He's in like your Marvel vs. Capcom games. You can play as him and the likes of them.
It's mad how Hiryu got the Mega Man treatment where they try to westernise him, didn't they?
Aye. Well, you look at a Japanese box, it kind of looks like the character does in the game, whereas on a Western box, he's this, what, as you say, Jean-Claude Van Damme looking guy in a leotard holding like a sword.
But I mean, it's as a testament to Mega Drive to see these things. I mean, in the day, in that day, 1990, the arcade was the cutting edge of gaming. There was no fucking like PlayStation or Xbox leading the way. They had to go to a coin-op to see what true gaming was like and what the cutting edge was like. And for the Mega Drive version to be higher rated than the arcade version, can you imagine being able to fucking play it in your house back then?
This is what a draw is. It's we did arcades weren't really as much a thing when we were Wayne's, so it didn't seem like the era of you can have it in the house had already came. So we grew up with that. If you had previously only known Strider as a standy up arcade cabinet, and then all of a sudden you could fucking play it on your telly, it would have been mind blowing at the time.
Aye. And I also seen like some things like Shinobi. I remember we've done Shinobi 3 on here. It reminded me of Shinobi. Shinobi was a bit less arcadey, but you could see like where Shinobi's influences came from. I'm pretty sure Shinobi 3's influences came from in this game. The moves and that you could do. Also, I seen a bit of Devil May Greet in it as well. Just like him moving about and just the kind of acrobatic stuff you can do. And the big baddies as well.
I was getting my feelers out for an episode title that might day. but aye.
But it's a really incredible game. It's difficult, man. It's fucking rock solid. But I tell you what, man. There's always a time that plays for these fucking games, man. These arcade ports on the Mega Drive are fucking timeless. Aye. And this is one, perhaps, that we don't talk about as often as like a Golden Axe, Streets of Rage, etc.
Aye.
But I mean, man. What can you say? You're never going to have a bad time. These games, these arcade ports on the Mega Drive, they've done them so well.
You appreciate getting a look at your Sega lineage.
Yeah, and they run so well, and they look so beautiful, man. I played this on my Mega Drive on a CRT, and it really makes all the difference. It looks like the arcade should have looked like. And I think that Sega Mega Drive games were built with a CRT, obviously, in mind, and you don't actually see how good they look until you look at them on that old fuzzy, static laden screen that you can taste and smell.
I'm a bit jealous, I'm not going to lie.
Sometimes I rub it back my horn over it just to get that familiar 90s feeling.
That's Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. We'll quickly dish out our games for next time then. I'm going to come in, McCormick, you're getting Morrowind, one of the best games of all time.
Amazing, can't wait to lose 200 hours to it.
Andy, what you got for me?
I've got a technical marvel for you, man. I'm going to give you X versus Sever on a Game Boy Advance.
Nice one. Mick?
I'm going to continue our weird trend of giving portable versions of much more popular and more regarded games. I'm going to give you Metal Gear Ghost Babel, however you pronounce it, for the Game Boy Color.
Solid Snake doesn't get snouts in this version.
Right.
He gets a fogger.
It's a vape.
Aye, they were ahead of their time. All that's left to say for me is up the workers.
Hardcore to the Mega.
Morning, Don.
See you later.